For AZPM, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at some of the cultural pieces that make up the artistic landscape of Southern Arizona. The Arizona Theater Company's new production of True West builds a powder keg of emotions in every performance. I'll talk with the artists who are bringing Sam Shepard's play to life on stage. The 42nd annual Tucson International Mariachi Conference is about to begin, a celebration of Mexican music, dance, food, and culture. Hear a little about what's in store. Learn about the Hamra Arts Club, a place in Tucson where refugee women from places like Iran, Afghanistan, and Syria are building sisterhood, making art, and embarking on the next chapter of their lives. And find out about the little-known history of Mariana Martinez, a composer from the 18th century who is friends with Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and meet the U of A grad who's made a concert of her work possible this Sunday. Those stories are next on Arizona Spotlight. Playwright Sam Shepard's True West made its stage debut in 1980 and quickly began winning awards and attracting the best and most ambitious actors and directors around the world. Just look it up. It tells the story of brothers Austin and Lee, who've been estranged for years, but they come to be isolated at their mom's house one hot summer, with their ambitions, frustrations, and their polar opposite philosophies coming to a boil. The fun starts when they unwillingly collaborate on a screenplay for a Western. Arizona Theater Company launches a new production this weekend, and to discuss it, I was joined by director Jen Thompson and the actors playing the brothers, Zach Fine and Rhett Guter. It's a very economical play. There's like four characters in one set. I want to know, Jen, did you feel at all confined or restrained by the play? What was your approach to handling such a possibly claustrophobic situation?
Well, I think it's claustrophobic on purpose. I love plays like that. And, you know, there's actually quite a lot that happens to that set. So from a technical point of view, we have our work cut out for us in an absolutely fantastically fun way. But no, I love that one set stuck in there, four actors talking kind of thing. So I didn't feel restricted by it. I felt inspired by it.
As a woman, how did relating to the masculinity in this play and the sort of conflict between brothers feel?
I guess, you know, I mean, I feel everything as a woman because I am one, but I didn't think of it that way. And I've been really lucky so far in my career, my directing career, that I have been able to bounce all over the place with all sorts of genres. And when Matt August asked me about the play, I mean, my just gut reaction was like, hell yeah, you know, just a badass play. So I didn't think about it like, what will I bring as a lady? My brother and I, you know, beat the hell out of each other. And I related to it that way, I guess.
There's a real intensity to this play. The conflict between the brothers reaches a few different peaks. So Rhett and Zach, I'd like to ask you guys about what it's like to generate that kind of energy on command.
Well, it's fun. I'd say, first of all, it's fun. You know, it's such a great play. And as you said, it's quite condensed or contained. It's sort of, it's both dense and has a brevity to it. And so it asks a lot of the actors. So you go, you start at an 11 and you go, you just keep going. You get to explore as an actor a lot of the unsocialized parts of being a human. You know, the parts of us that act out or feel huge things or express wild and complicated emotions that we don't always get to express on a daily basis in a safe way. So it's a privilege, actually, to explore those parts of us that make us human.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the relationship of being brothers is sort of the foundation for part of what is Zach's talking about for me, is that you are unsocialized with your siblings. You do have a period of time where you're acting out and you're not behaved, essentially. the way the play sort of taps into some of that, you know, abandonment and reckless behavior that you would not do publicly. And there's even a great scene where a new character comes in and it shifts what that is. So playing with those dynamics. I would also say the text is amazing. The way Shepherd has structured each scene builds on itself, and it's such poetry without feeling necessarily like poetry, that it's just a great catalyst for all that exploration.
Without spoiling any of the events of the play, can you give me an estimate of how many toasters might be tortured in a given night?
I guess it depends on your definition of tortured, but I think we have 25 toasters on stage. So we have a lot of toasters.
Okay.
And some of them are put through their paces.
Mm-hmm. Some don't make it out alive.
Something that struck me, Jen, when I was watching the 1984 version is the way this play kind of explores the creative process in an unexpected way. That along with the relationship between the brothers, we also have them attempting to create art. And it deconstructs the writing process that is behind all the plays and films and TV shows that we've all been exposed to for so long. What about that aspect of the play?
I love it also because it feels so meta in that, you know, Sam Shepard is clearly having a conversation with himself about what that process is and the pressure of that process, trying to create an outcome that is on one side artistically fulfilling and on the other side commercially rewarding. And I think that as actors and as artists in the theater, we can all relate to that also. So I love all the ways that the play folds in on itself. You know, they're like these fabulous booby traps that just keep going off that I've read it, of course, a million times now, but not until we stepped into the room, really, and Zach and Rhett started to really take a whack at it. Did some of that stuff come to the fore?
Rhett, as the more perhaps scholarly brother, the brother who has painted within the lines for most of his life, how do you approach the idea of having a brother as antagonistic as Lee is? He bullies you, and yet somehow your character finds a way to both cozy up to him and to slowly try to take power, to take the upper hand in the relationship.
Yeah, I think Austin tries to find a way to do that, but is ultimately pretty unsuccessful. You know, I am the older brother in my family, so it's been an interesting exploration to sort of think back to what must it have been like for my younger brother. I have a younger brother that's 6 years younger than me, and that dynamic of trying to get the upper hand, I think, is mostly by being dismissive of saying this is not a valid energy in the world, in society, and ultimately through the play learns that there is a lot of value to that. And then it kind of flips into a desire to understand something that he's been dismissive of his entire life.
Zach, I told you when I first met you and I found out you were playing Lee that you terrified me because even though I didn't have an older brother, I still find his character and the constant prodding that he does at other people's boundaries, other people's safe zones. Do you feel like you're walking a tightrope sometimes in terms of making your character sympathetic? Are you antagonizing the audience in some way?
Well, I don't know if I'm doing either. I think I'm trying to honestly understand the needs and the wants of this human that Sam Shepard's created. If you do that with an integrity, then I think you just try to attach as deeply as possible to the thing that that character needs and wants. And in this particular circumstance, those needs and wants are pretty huge and come from a place that's pretty painful.
Yeah, Lee has really big appetites, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah, a real unlived life in a way, or a desire to gain control, dominance over the world and the people around him. It must come from, you know, some deep lack of control that was enacted upon him at some point. But yeah, he's certainly living out that need for control and dominance to a degree that is not, I mean, if I'm stepping out and judging it, not healthy, yeah. But incredibly fun to play.
Thanks to my guests, director Jen Thompson, and actors Rhett Guter and Zach Fine. Arizona Theater Company presents True West in Tucson, April 27th through May 18th, before the production will travel to Phoenix. You can connect with the schedule through the Spotlight page at azpm.org. A major cultural event in our community is about to celebrate its 42nd anniversary. The first week in May, the Tucson International Mariachi Conference returns for 5 days of performances, workshops, and celebration. Next, Tony Paniagua spoke with Jose Jimenez, one of 30 board members that worked together to present this annual gathering.
Jose Jimenez is a board member with Tucson International Mariachi Conference. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
Jose, I just met you a few minutes ago, and you were telling me that you are a Tucson native, and the Tucson International Mariachi Conference is dear to you. Can you tell us how you discovered it and how it's grown along the way for you?
Yes, absolutely. I'm actually not sure how I discovered it, but many years ago, about 1988 is when I remember, I started attending the concerts just out of something that I enjoyed myself. And then eventually my daughters went to Davis Bilingual Elementary, and they left mariachi for soccer, and the mariachis kept me. So I now sit on the board of directors.
What did you find as far as being on the board of directors that has kept you there for so many years?
It's just an exciting dynamic. We're a working board, so we have to get in there, dig, develop, design, and do whatever it takes to produce quite a few shows and the curriculum for the students.
And what is the history of this conference for those people who may not have heard about it before?
So the Mariachi Conference goes way back to 1983. It was originally a fundraiser for La Frontera, and now we sit under the umbrella of La Frontera. So La Frontera helps us a lot.
Which is a mental health and substance abuse organization?
That is correct, yeah.
So what is happening this year?
We're excited to bring in Sol de Mexico by Jose Hernandez, a Los Angeles group who has won several Grammy Awards, and we're bringing in Jonathan Palomar, who is the vocalist for Mariachi Vargas.
There are multiple events that are held, and it's not just about attending to listen to music. There are things that you do for the public. For example, you were mentioning there are workshops, there's a vocal competition. Let's just hear about a little bit more about these.
So the events start on Wednesday, May the 1st, with a singing competition at the MSA Annex. Children have to try out by submitting videotape. And so we're down to the finalists. So Wednesday evening, the finalists will compete in an American Idol-style competition. And the winners go on to participate in the main concert. Thursday is the student showcase, where quite a few of the groups, I think we have 22 acts this year, that will be in the student showcase. And that's a good opportunity for the students to show off for their parents and their families on a big stage. Friday is El Concierto Espectacular, and that is the spectacular where Jose Hernandez will perform and Jonathan Palomar along with others. And Saturday is Fiesta Garibaldi at Jacome Plaza. And it all ends on Sunday the 5th with Mariachi Mass at San Agustin's Cathedral.
I remember attending many years ago at Armory Park, and it was a free event. That is no longer the case. No more free events. Can you tell us why that's happening?
Yes, not at this time. The cost to produce these events with sound, lighting, staging, and everything else that goes into it. Unfortunately, we don't have a capital sponsor that can carry the bulk of that. We do have some very kind, generous sponsors. But when you put all of these events together, plus the educational component, which is heavily subsidized, we have to charge for the bulk of it.
And I do know that volunteers have actually offset many of the costs as well.
Yes, we are grateful. We get volunteers, which are heavily needed for all the events that are happening. So there's volunteer opportunities, and we encourage volunteers. And so, yes, they help tremendously.
Jose, how significant do you think this conference is to Tucson, to Southern Arizona at large?
It's absolutely significant. I've heard that even people in Mexico will credit this conference with keeping the art of mariachi music and ballet folklorico alive. As sometimes here in the States, we care a little bit more for the culture as we seek for it. But for a myriad of reasons, it is huge for the preservation of the culture, for the building of community, for the building of youth and tradition and culture. It can go on and on.
What has it done for you personally, and what will it continue to do? Why is this so important for you, Jose Jimenez?
It has enriched my life beyond anything that I could consider. I love music as a whole, and you'll often catch me at a variety of shows. But this event and being involved with it just has brought me into community. I collaborate with many, many people, and it's just fascinating all that goes into it and all that has made me stretch myself and put myself out there for the sake of community. And that's a part I didn't know I had in me.
Jose, many people have heard of mariachis because of our proximity to Mexican culture here in Arizona. But of course, there are people who don't know much about it. What would you like to say about the history of this musical genre and perhaps how people will connect when they hear it for the first time?
Well, everything about mariachi is historical. And while I can't, you will see from the uniforms to the pageantry in ballet folklorico, every dress is about a different state in Mexico. So there's certainly a lot of material to delve in, even superficially.
Obviously, we all hear that music is an international language. Do you feel that this is the case?
I do believe that. That's how I'm able to connect with it, even though it is part of my culture. When I see a performance, I see the skill that it takes, almost like watching a sporting event. So you understand what it takes for a vocalist to do what it does, or a musician or a dancer to do what they do.
Jose Jimenez is a board member with Tucson International Mariachi Conference. Thank you very much and good luck this year.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
The Tucson International Mariachi Conference begins Wednesday, May 1st and runs through Sunday, May 5th with daily activities, events, and concerts. You can find the schedule at tucsonmariachi.org. Have you ever asked yourself, how can an individual continue to make art when their life may be on the brink of collapse? How can we help ourselves to create a new world when the one that we knew has been eliminated? Next, meet multidisciplinary artist and educator Naza Farin Lotfi. She is the founder of the Hamra Arts Club. Their mission is to help female refugees find a safe space to continue their art, begin the journey to the next chapter of their lives, and find peace and sisterhood. This interview is hosted by Lauren Roth, concertmaster for the Tucson Symphony Orchestra and assistant professor of violin at the University of Arizona.
We're happy to be joined now by Naza Farin Lotfi and her student Madaw Sayed Obed to talk more about the Hamra Arts Club. Thanks for joining me today. Share a little bit about Hamra.
At first, I didn't think about Hamra Arts Club as an art project. It was something I was called into doing because I know how hard it is to just move to a new country, you know, to start a new life. I experienced it in a very different way at a later age as an international student. And I came to go to the US to go to a school, so I immediately had a community. But I could feel how hard it is. And I was heartbroken about what happened to Afghanistan and to Afghans. And we are siblings. Like, I'm Iranian, and we share a language and we share a culture. And also with Syrians, like what they went through, the displacement is painful. And then coming here with no support, I felt pain. And so I wanted to do something that was meaningful, but also at my capacity, because I'm not a social worker. And that's why it became an arts club. But gradually, the more we got together, it just felt right.
Madaw, I'm curious how you got involved in Hamra.
So when I first got here, they didn't even know the difference between Farsi and Arabic. When I started in fifth grade elementary school, they brought me an Arabic-speaking girl to translate for me. And I was like, I don't speak Arabic. So we cannot communicate. So we had to communicate all through, you know, Google Translate, and we couldn't really connect because they had no idea of what, you know, Afghanistan looks like. It's all about the stereotypes of, you know, all Afghans are poor and all, you know, the negative stuff. So I always felt like I wasn't supposed to be there. I wasn't supposed to be the person who I was. Like, I wasn't really supposed to express my culture because of, like, how low I felt. So I would really would like if people educated themselves more on, you know, the Asian culture or, you know, the other cultures, because Asia is really diverse. It's literally the biggest continent in the world. And they should, you know, educate themselves more on the culture and the languages and know the difference between Farsi and Arabic and Turkish, because they're totally not the same, not even from the same, you know, language family. Just be aware of others and the existence of other cultures and languages, so the students from those cultures would feel more comfortable. So my sister was in Hamra's art club before I got in. I went there and then I met Naza Farin. I loved how we were doing meaningful art. We were getting into a little like politics. We did a lot of projects at Hamra. We did a lot of protesting stuff, protesting people who are, you know, taking women's right of education and freedom away from women. We were celebrating women because women are awesome. Later on, I like noticed how like Hamra has helped me to become a better version of myself and learn how to become brave. You know, we were talking about our feelings, especially for refugees like us who really went through a lot as kids and really had to grow up fast. And honestly, I see a lot of new, you know, girls around my age or younger than me also have like the same confidence as me even more and want to do actually something and change the world in a better way. So I'm really excited, really proud of being in Hamra.
I'm curious how you came to be an advocate for the arts as a unifier.
I do believe that when you come together around art, there are spaces and places you can go together. Like, we are all gonna like feel a little bit more vulnerable and not be scared of our vulnerability. Having access to a safe space to express what is going on inside is a key. And what I learned from some of the youth that I have encountered through this project is that some of our schools, unfortunately, are not equipped to help them out as they enter this culture, this society, the school system. The culture is not known to people. The language barrier, they don't speak Spanish nor English. So they're really like excluded. And what I have come to believe that gathering and connecting to each other and allowing ourselves to take off our masks and be ourselves and engage in a creative project, if it's a drawing or if it's a bodily movement or if it's a creative writing, that allows them to let out some of the steam that builds up every week and then work with it. And try to have fun and play and experiment. I think these are all the great things of that art can bring.
Well, this might be a little bit of a naive question, but what maybe gave you the courage to actually create? You imagined a space like this, but then you went ahead and executed it and made it possible for students like Mado to participate.
That's a good question. I have always been concerned with creating a space in my visual work. And I have always dreamt of new orders for this new space, which we can also call it like a new world or a world-making practice. So theoretically and conceptually, I have been preparing myself for so many years. A lot of times the narratives we hear from different peoples, specifically from the people of the Middle East, they're very reductive. What you hear on the media is one sentence or maybe a paragraph, no complexity. And we all have lived lives that are not projected in the external world that we are living. And it is important for all of us to remember that, the moments that have changed us to become who we are, the moment that you cross a border and there is a new flag and you know a world is behind you and it's gone forever. And those forever is going to change that person. And they're going to forget it because they're going to be exposed to the narrative about them that is not personal. It's cliche, it's a stereotype, and is often embedded in war and violence and removed from human connection. And those human connections are what makes us who we are as people. And Hamrah is trying to be that place of connection for us who have lost the people in our lives, our networks, our society, and rebuild that slowly in a new place. In Tucson, there is a need. It really was an experiment in time and a space to allow it become what it is.
Thank you so much, Naza Farin and Maddow, for sharing your experience and for talking to us a bit about the Hamrah Arts Club.
That interview was part of AZPM's State of the Arts program. You can find the video at azpm.org. The work of an important but largely forgotten female composer from the time of Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven will be receiving a 21st century premiere this weekend in Tucson. Next, an interview with the choral conductor who has made this possible.
I'm Andy Bade, music host for Classical 90.5 AZPM. With me today in the studio is James Higgs. James, welcome to our studio.
Thank you for having me.
You recently completed your doctorate in choral conducting at the U of A, and you had a focus on underrepresented composers. What got you into that as an area of particular study?
That particular focus was a part of the choral literature courses that I took, which were taught by Dr. Elizabeth Schauer, who's the director of choral activities at the U of A. We learn about a wide range of composers throughout history, and there's an emphasis on underrepresented composers.
In scholarship, there are some inherent biases that we all have, of course. You know, historical musicology got started in late 19th century in Germany, and of course they were interested in German composers. What are ways that you see that you can do that can bring a new focus on some of these people?
For some of these composers, especially like the composer that I did my research on, Mariano Martinez, there isn't really the mythology that that is associated with composers like Mozart and Beethoven, where their stories are the ones that we preoccupy ourselves mostly on. And so for me, when I was doing my research, you know, I was learning about different styles of music that I didn't learn about earlier, or learning about, you know, genres that I didn't know about.
So you mentioned Mariana Martinez. Could you tell us a little more about her? Who was she? When did she live? What did she do?
She's an 18th century composer. She was born in Vienna in 1744. Her father worked for the Pope and the papal office, and through her connection with her father, Pietro Metastasio, who was a very famous opera librettist, lived with their family, and so she had Metastasio as a mentor. And so she was kind of like a Mozart in that she was a prolific performer and also composed a lot as from a young age. And so Empress Maria Theresa, you know, would have her perform in her court often. I believe through the connection of Metastasio, she found herself connected with a lot of important figures in Vienna in the 1760s through 1790s. So she composed a ton of church music and also composed oratorios and things like that. And after her death in 1812, her music became more obscure. There is some writing about her. You know, music historian Charles Burney wrote about her in his volumes on his travel. Yeah, she was a very influential person during her lifetime in Viennese music circles, and also became pretty famous in Italy. She was the first woman to be inducted as a member of the Accademia Filarmonica di Bologna, which was a professional academy for, you know, people who wanted to become maestro di cappella. There's different things about her history that seem really impressive looking back, but I had never heard of her before I took a choral literature course, and Dr. Schauer introduced her to me.
So here she was, born just, what, 12 years before Mozart, born mm-hmm. in Vienna, well-known there, it seems, and well-liked, and wrote a lot of music, and then kind of disappears. obviously Mozart's shadow and Haydn's and mm-hmm. Beethoven's are right. very long shadows.
Yes.
It's hard to get for anybody to get any recognition, especially though if you're a woman in those days. I believe you've made a performance edition of one of her masses.
Yeah, so my project for my doctorate was to create a critical edition of her third mass, which was the first known public performance by one of her works. It was performed in the St. Michael's Church in Vienna in 1761. That was kind of the piece that put her into the public eye, and she started composing much more after that, a lot of church music, actually, which I think was unique for that time because, you know, if most of the music being heard in churches would be by the church directors, male composers, yeah.
So you did a portion of that on your lecture recital, but coming up, I believe there is a concert with the U of A choir and Dr. Elizabeth Schauer conducting the entire mass?
Yes. It's on April 28th at Grace St. Paul at 3 p.m., and it features members of the TSO orchestra and local soloists. I did, for my lecture recital, just because of time constraints, I only did the first 25 minutes of the mass and performed it with orchestra and recital choir. And then this will be the full mass, the full setting of the mass with orchestra.
So about how large is that? How many people and how long is that one?
It'll be, I would say, between 45 and 50 minutes long. And then the orchestra is around 28 members.
Was this originally written as a concert mass, or was it really written for church that has now become kind of a concert type piece?
Well, in Vienna, they had a big tradition of big orchestras with their masses, especially on feast days. So this was a feast day mass. So it was a solemn mass. So it had this full orchestration with it already. So yeah, it was for a pretty big occasion, and it's festive, as you would say.
Yeah. I've been speaking with Dr. James Higgs, whose research has brought to light the important contributions of Viennese classical era composer Mariana Martinez. I'm Andy Bade for AZPM.
The modern premiere of a mass by composer Mariana Martinez, performed by the U of A Symphonic Choir conducted by Dr. Elizabeth Schauer, will be at Grace St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Tucson this Sunday, April 28th at 3 p.m. We have more information on the Spotlight page at azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show is a production of AZPM. The music is by Calexico. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. Production assistance from Alicia Vasquez. I'm producer and host Mark McLemore.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.